Thanks for joining us for the Executive Series. Today I'm speaking with Hamish Douglass, who is the Chief Investment Officer and CEO of the Magellan Financial Group. Hamish, it's always a treat to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
A pleasure, Tom.
There's so much going on at the moment.
There is a few things going
on. It's a, interestingly, like just top of mind, what would you list as the factors that, not necessarily keeping you awake, but keeping you alert at night?
Yeah, I think the two big factors that are really thinking about how the world will play out from here, of course, is interest rates in the United States and what's happening. And we've seen a backflip by the Fed that was probably not expected at the end of last year. So there's a change of course. What does that all mean? Obviously, markets are liking that. And then we've got the whole trade issues with the Trump administration, particularly China and the United States, and the markets are now pricing that's all going to be settled.
Yep.
And the question is it all going to be settled, or is this just round one in a series of rounds? So they're probably the two big issues at the moment. Obviously, the markets are pricing that they're going to get a settlement, and they're liking what the Fed's saying at the moment.
Yep.
So,
yep.
But is that the reality?
Indeed. Now, you make a good point about the Fed and a backflip. I mean, the yield curve's almost done a backflip as well.
Yep.
It's inverted from time to time. How much credence do you put in the behaviour of the yield curve? Because historically, it's been a precursor for a slowdown in the economy. We're coming off the back of the biggest stimulus via QE in financial history. Does it still hold currency?
Well, I think we're in a very unusual point in history of what's going on at the moment. Normally when the yield curve inverts is when the economies are roaring ahead, inflation's picking up, and the central banks are still tightening interest rates. So what they do is they drive up short-term interest rates, and then the markets and the long-term interest rates don't go up, and they're expecting that the activity of the central bank is effectively going to slow down the economies. And therefore you often get a recession after an inversion of the yield curve. But we've got something quite different going on here at the moment. We've got an inverted yield curve, but the Federal Reserve, well, parts of the yield curve inverted, but the Federal Reserve has now stopped increasing interest rates. If anything, they're not trying to stop the economy growing, they're trying to support the economy growing. So it's a very unusual, and it's actually a very flat and a very low inverted yield curve. So I wouldn't necessarily think that it's predicting an imminent recession like you would typically get with an inverted yield curve.
So it really begs the question, have we seen the peak in interest rates in this cycle, which is extraordinary that the peak would be so low?
Well, the answer is I don't know the answer to that question. I think if anyone is overconfident in knowing that answer,
they're in trouble.
I would be a bit in trouble. Certainly it appears to have flattened this peak, and our view is that it's flattened the peak. We may have thought that long-term interest rates may, like the 10-year rate in the US may have peaked out at 4 in this cycle. It may well peak out materially less than 4 in this cycle. So what are the, obviously the Fed's trying to be very accommodative at the moment, and they're not seeing a lot of inflation pressures, and they're just hoping that they can get through this cycle without a spike up in inflation. Okay, if that happens, I think we're going to have a pretty low peak to this interest rate cycle. And we do think there are some very long structural reasons why long-term rates are going to be materially lower than they were in the past. But it's a very relevant question what happens in this cycle as opposed to the long-term issue. What's going to cause that to be wrong? It's inflation.
Yep.
So, you know, if the Fed sees inflation starting to come in the economy, and we're seeing wages growing at around 3.2% in the United States, and we see a lot of cost pressures in businesses, but we haven't actually seen the core inflation data go above 2% really in the United States. If that starts feeding through and we do get a spike of inflation, that means interest rates are going to peak materially higher than the Fed and the markets are currently expecting at the moment.
Yeah.
If that was to happen, and nobody knows, if that was to happen, hold on to your seats. The markets are not pricing any real inflation. The Fed, I think, have their fingers crossed that they can keep accommodative here and actually go lower in terms of interest rates than they would ordinarily go. And it's quite a backflip on that, on what the Fed has done here.
Compared
it's very
to where
unusual
we were,
in
like
history that they have hit the pause button on tightening at this point in the in the cycle. I'm not saying they're wrong,
yep.
because there are scenarios where what the Fed is doing is very logical, particularly when we got in December, the financial tightening we had, yep. and then we had slowdown in economic activity around the world. So then becoming more cautious about tightening interest rates, there was a lot of data around that was probably telling them they should go more cautious. But does that mean inflation won't happen? You know, you're a brave person to bet that, because if it happens, the consequences for markets could be pretty severe.
Tariffs have got the ability to be inflationary, and do you think that the US economy has seen the impact of the most recent tariffs that have been applied?
Look, it's very minor. I think you have to look at the US economy. You know, net trade's probably about 10, 11, 12% of the economy. So yep. the tradable sector's not a huge part of the US economy. They've got a very, very large domestic base yep. of what really drives their economy. And then what's had tariffs applied to it is a very small proportion of the total imports going to the United
yep.
States.
Yep.
So I think you need to size the total impact on the total economy, and the overall inflationary impact is very modest from the tariffs that have been put in place.
Indeed. So when it comes to trade, where does that reside in the echelon of concerns for you?
It does, because at the centre of the trade dispute is not about trade deficits. No. You know, that's a political argument that's been run about jobs and everything in America. At the centre of the real trade dispute is actually a geopolitical dispute between China and the United States. And it's really about supremacy in the world, and particularly technological supremacy in the medium term. And, you know, there are some very legitimate things that the US is raising. You know, Trump is the first one who's been so forceful in raising issues that everyone else, including Australia, talks about behind the scenes, but yeah. never really tackles China on. They have been competing with an unfair advantage. The question is China really going to give up some of those advantages in this dispute? And therefore, I think this could be a rolling issue over many, many years. I don't think these tensions, they may dissipate in the short term, looks like there are settlements, but at the end of the day, there is a clash between the United States and I'd say other Western countries, including Australia, and what the ambitions of China are and whether they're competing fairly there or not. So we may well get a settlement in the short term, but I don't think this is the last we're going to hear about these issues.
Well, enforcement's a big issue as well. Like, you might arrive at a conclusion, but the enforceability of it is another question as well.
Yeah, well, they're talking about that the United States would have the right to put tariffs on China if they breach, but China should have no right of retaliation.
Indeed.
Is China actually going to agree to that? In agreement, let's see what unfolds.
Okay, so let's become a little more micro in terms of what you're thinking. Historically, you've had quite a fondness for the big consumer multinational staple brands, which have offered impressive defensive qualities. Things have changed a little bit with Amazon most recently, because they have distorted that entire landscape. How are you thinking about that universe at present?
Yeah, well, certainly the economic moats around many of the big consumer staple brands in the world. And at the peak, we probably had 40% of our portfolio in big multinational consumer franchises. Businesses like Colgate and Procter & Gamble and Unilever and Nestle. We owned a whole series. Colgate was in there as well. We own very, very few of those things today. We've still got a position in Nestle, yep. For instance. It's a fantastic company. But you're right, the landscape is changing. There are two reasons I think these big consumer franchises were so powerful. And it was really about the power of the supermarkets. They had a limited amount of shelf space, and really because of the velocity on the shelves, the only ones who could afford to buy the shelf space was the big brands. And the reason the supermarkets would have the big brands is because they had the power of the share of mind in advertising. And I really think it was television advertising gave a huge barrier to entry. If you wanted to come up with a new toothpaste brand or a new razor brand or a new cosmetics or something, it was very, very hard to get any share of mind. And you literally had to afford to go and advertise during the AFL or something in order to get where the audiences were. And the barriers to do that was enormous. So it was Procter & Gamble's of the world and the Unilever's of the world and the Nestle's of the world who dominated the share of your mind. And once you'd heard about something, you walk in the supermarket and odds on the way advertising works, you buy the brand that, that you've been reinforced on television. Two things are happening here. First of all, the share of mind with what's happening is in social media, in Instagram, for instance, and in Facebook and other places. You can have a relatively small brand and the influences and things, people can rapidly get share without having to go and advertise on television with the AFL. And ultimately, the television advertising complex is going to break down, and that's reducing the barriers to entry for new brands. And retailing's changing. You mentioned Amazon. Amazon doesn't have a limited amount of shelf space. Effectively, if you can get a share of mind, there's an unlimited number of shelves in an Amazon world. So suddenly you could then go and list with Amazon. You have to pay them, but you can get a shelf space if you can get brand awareness. And therefore, the barriers to entry are coming down, and that's why the sales growth of these great consumer franchises, they probably used to grow at 3-5% a year. A lot of them are growing at 2% per year, and it may go south, and the economics are just very different, growing at 2% as opposed to growing at 5% a year, and that's one reason that it's being disrupted.
So we're really in a new frontier in terms of brand building. What are the emerging brands in this new technology-ridden landscape that has taken your fancy?
Well, we probably don't really invest in that emerging sort of brands. We like dominant brands, but we want businesses that are probably not really going to be disrupted by that channel. So an old brand that I would say is a fabulous brand is actually the snacks business owned by PepsiCo. They own a business called Frito-Lay in North America. Its sales growth has not changed in a decade. They have 65% market share of effectively chips in the United States. And we would say that people's snacking habits aren't changing, and shipping sort of packets of chips around are probably not really going to be attacked. It's a convenience purchase attacked by Amazon. So we still like some brands where we really think about their channels to market and whether they're going to be fundamentally disrupted here or not. We do like the platforms. Yep. We don't own Amazon, but it's a fabulous platform. But we do own Facebook, which is a platform for advertising. We own Google. It's a platform for advertising. And we think both of those businesses will take a material amount of the $200 billion in television advertising revenue. And we think, and even if you listen to Tim Cook at Apple, he thinks fundamentally the television industry is going to go through a radical change in the next 5 years or so. And we would actually agree with him that that's going to happen. So we're looking for the platforms and the changes in the business. But there are some old brands that we still like, and the ones that we think are much less susceptible to be disrupted by Amazon in particular, but also by social media.
Are these new platforms, in inverted commas, the new railways? Because you could make a case that governments have been very light in terms of their interference with these organisations as they have emerged, but there's a lot more scrutiny being placed on the value of privacy and the level of intrusion that these organisations can bring to an individual's life. Were we at the beginnings of some headwinds for these groups?
Yeah, well, they are like railways, but they are different to railways. You know, at the end of the day, most of the antitrust legislation in the world looks at the consumer and whether the concentration of power is effectively increasing prices at the consumer level. And of course, because data hasn't been valued, a lot of these services are given away for free.
Yep.
And actually, the Amazons of the world have been bringing prices down. So from a consumer point of view, it hasn't been apparent to the antitrust regulators that these businesses have in any way harmed consumers, and most of the competition laws don't actually deal with it. But are we, just because that's the case, are we complacent that these very dominant businesses aren't going to have some form of regulatory reaction on privacy and other issues that could impact their businesses in some way? you have to be very mindful of these, because these are the most powerful business models that have been developed in the world in the last 30 to 50 years.
Indeed.
So you can't ignore the pattern, and the market share that these businesses have in their segments are like the monopoly railroads, but they're different in how they face the consumer.
What excites you most when you look out over the course of the next couple of years in terms of the opportunities emerging?
What excites me the most? Obviously, we've had a lot of exposure to different technology areas. I think we're in a very early stage of cloud-based computing. And I think the amount of money that is spent per annum on businesses and individuals with their computing power and where it's located, and the relocation of those services into a cloud environment, we're talking over $1 trillion of opportunity, and we're in very, very early days there. So we're spending a lot of time thinking and looking at that area of thinking how that world will evolve, and are there very, very good business opportunities. We have a large investment in Microsoft, and it has one of the three hyperscale cloud hosting platforms in the world. One's owned by Amazon, called Amazon Web Services, which is the market leader at the moment. Fabulous how Bezos saw that opportunity when none of the tech companies saw it. Number two player in the world is Azure, and Azure is owned by Microsoft. And the third player, somewhat behind, is actually owned by Google. I'm talking about outside of China. Obviously, yep. China is a world unto itself, where Alibaba would be the number one player in that sort of cloud infrastructure business. But we're talking very large markets and very early on in the adoption of what's happening.
Hamish, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Really grateful for your time. Thank you.
A pleasure, Tom.
And thanks for joining us for the Executive Series.